science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, it's now time for Dear Science, live in the studio with Alan Blackman. Before that, you heard New Zealand First's Tracy Martin. It's 28 minutes past 12 and you're tuned into The Wire. So, 15th century Korea witnessed what was suspected to be the birth of a new star, which lit up the sky for 14 nights, but it turns out that was something altogether different. Is that right, Alan?
Yeah, indeed. So, there's a paper published in Nature this week, which does date back all the way to 1437, and specifically March the 11th, 1437, where some Korean astronomers at that time saw a very, very bright light in the sky that hadn't been there before. Mm. And it persisted for around about 2 weeks and then pretty much disappeared. And so they fortunately made note of this. And I guess since that time, people have been wondering what that particular light was. And now they've pretty much figured it out and they know what it was and where it now is. So the way...
It's a nova.
It is. Right. It's a nova. Yeah. Okay. So you've probably heard of supernovas.
Yeah.
And so a supernova is when a single star explodes. So gets near the end of its life, sort of collapses in on itself and then just enormous bang. Mm. A nova is when you've got a binary star system. So in fact, you've got two stars basically rotating around each other. And one of those stars is a white dwarf, which is a dead star. So that's one that's basically been through the business and collapsed in on itself. And the other one is just a star like our sun, something like that. And so these guys are busy rotating around each other quite quickly. They're pretty close. What then happens is that the white dwarf takes hydrogen away from the large star, and it starts accumulating this hydrogen as they're busy rotating around each other. Accumulates, eventually gets to the point where the gravitational pull of the white dwarf on the hydrogen is so great that you then get a hydrogen bomb, basically, which is what it is. So you get uncontrollable nuclear fusion, and when that happens, then there's a massive explosion, just like a hydrogen bomb, and it doesn't persist for very long. So this is why back in 1437 they only saw this for around about 2 weeks and then it disappeared. So that was what the system was thought to be. They didn't quite know which particular star it was. They knew where it was in the sky because the Korean astronomers had said that it was in the constellation of Scorpius. And so workers over in England, I think it was, were using historical star photos or sky photos from way back in about the 1920s to try and figure out the apparent motion of all these possible stars in that particular constellation. And what they needed to do was sort of track that back to 1437 by knowing how much that particular, or these particular stars had moved since the present day, and it was 1923, something like that, where they had the old plates from. And knowing how much it moved in that time, they could then figure how much it must have moved in the time since 1923 and 1437, and work backwards, etc., etc. And now they've pinpointed exactly where this was and what it is. And again, using historical star data, they've also seen small, what they call dwarf novae or nova. And basically, this system, once it's done its nova thing, you've still got the two constituent parts. You've still got the white dwarf. You've still got the star. And they keep rotating around each other, and the whole system keeps going. And you have these sort of mini novas where you get this slight increase in brightness periodically. And this happened in sort of 1934, 1935, 1942. They found that from the old star charts. And so they're pretty sure that this is what is happening in this case, that it's a binary system and it's still rotating. And eventually, after goodness knows 100,000 years or something like that, the whole thing will build up again to a particular...
Yeah, because that's all part of its life cycle, yeah, right? It starts off with this explosion, but that's not even the end. Because it just continues and then it rebuilds into another nova.
Indeed, until it's used all of the hydrogen in the companion star, and then you've got a couple of white dwarfs, and that'll be that. So kind of cool. They worked that out using the old data. So, these are photos from the 1920s or so. So it just goes to show how accurate, I guess, they were in those days. And again, the Korean astronomers way back in the 1400s, they were very accurate with the placement of where they saw this bright light coming from, and you know, and yeah, it all works. So nice piece of science, that.
My question for you, Alan, is with why do you laugh already?
Well, come on.
We know it's
with my limited space knowledge. To become a white dwarf, doesn't a star have to explode first?
Yeah, that's
so. How does the white dwarf and another star stay next to each other if the white dwarf exploded? Wouldn't it take out the other one, or do they move into each other's gravitational pull?
No, apparently not. Apparently, you can see in the photos there's this big sort of shell of sort of ejected material. That's what they can see at the moment, and that's obviously the remnants of the explosion. But the explosion doesn't destroy the whole system, so
okay,
it's big enough to be seen, but it's not big enough to actually sort of blow these puppies apart. So.
And when these astronomers saw this thing for 2 weeks, you said?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Was it just a bright light? Okay.
Yeah, apparently just a bright light, and then bonf, nothing.
For so, 2 weeks, that's crazy.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So I'm still trying to get my head around this next one. Single molecule spinning nanomachines, whatever they are, able to open up membranes in people even. And so this is to kill cells and maybe deliver a final solution of curing cancer or some such.
There you go. Wouldn't it be great if we could cure cancer? So obviously, in order to do that, we've got to kill cells. You've got to kill specific cells.
Yeah.
And that's very, very easy in a petri dish. You can kill cells with, you know, a little bit of bleach. That'll do it. In the human body, that's a different matter. So what these people in Houston in Texas have been doing, and again just published in Nature this week, is to make what they call nanomachines. Now, this is all part of nanotechnology, and you hear sort of in the popular media that, the dangers of all these nanomachines, they're going to be terrible things, and you're going to get nanorobots and nanoarmies, and they're going to, you know, have nanowars and all this sort of rubbish. But basically what these nanomachines that these guys have designed are is essentially little drills or rotors, essentially. So as you correctly said, if we're going to kill a cell, we've got one of two choices. You can either blow it apart, or you can inject something into it that's going to kill the cell from the inside. So what these guys have done is to take these particular molecules, and these particular molecules are static under normal circumstances, but as soon as you hit them with ultraviolet light, they suddenly start rotating at around about 2 to 3 megahertz. That's 2 to 3 million times a second, okay? And the molecules have got, for want of a better description, big wings on them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're big sort of linear molecules with big wings on them. And these puppies are busy rotating very, very, very rapid rates. And what they do is basically drill straight through the cell membrane. And in doing so, they can either completely disrupt the cell membrane so that the whole guts of the cell just basically spills out and the cell dies. Or they can take a what's called a payload molecule, which is something that's toxic to the innards of the cell. They can drill through the cell membrane into the innards of the cell and then deliver that payload and thereby kill the cell. So this is really, really, really nice science. And in fact, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry last year was awarded to three scientists who have been instrumental in making these nanomachines. And by a nanomachine, we mean a molecule that you can get to do something.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, I've got this misconception. I feel like a lot of people would have a misconception through like sci-fi movies and things like that. Of a little robot with laser beams and a propeller or whatever flying through your blood. But it's not a metallic or robotic thing.
No, it's just a molecule. Yeah, that's all it is. So, it's a totally inanimate object.
So yes, no one can hack these robots. And well, they're not robots, are they? Yeah.
No, they're not robots. They're just molecules. That's all that they are. And they've got a particular shape which then gives them a particular function that you can exploit. And that's the whole point of nanomachines, is basically, you know, getting things like rotors and wheels and things like that on the nanoscale so that you can get perhaps molecules that can mesh together and spin each other, you know, just like cogs do on the macro scale. They've made, you know, ridiculous things. They've made little nano cars that have got these, you know, circular wheels on them that they can actually get to sort of travel. They've made these rotor things, obviously, now that can potentially do, you know, bad things to bad cells. And, you know, potentially we're looking at something that could be used in treatment of, you know, diseases such as cancer. So it'll obviously be a long way down the track. But, you know, it really is a very, very impressive piece of work, and conceptually a very, very simple idea, because once you know that you can make these molecules that can spin at rapid rates, then, you know, what are you going to do with them? Well, hell, let's drill into a cell. Mm. And like many great discoveries, it's very, very obvious in hindsight, and it makes you sort of think, shit, why didn't I think of that?
And in the realm of conspiracy theories, we've got a new one that a mysterious planet called Nibiru is about to collide with the Earth and destroy it and probably all life, I guess.
We are doomed.
What do we think about that one?
What do we think about that? We think, the royal we, that the Herald should not have printed this. Okay, so thumbs down to the Herald on this one.
Am I wrong in thinking that a lot of these kind of stories seem to appear on the Herald? I hear a lot about new alien race discovered. Yeah. And I mean, it just feels like a frequent trend.
Well, in their defense, I guess, they often seem to be reprinted from the Daily Mail, that bastion of, you know, journalistic integrity and truth, in the Trumpian sense, I guess. But, right, so for the listeners, so the headlines were claims new planet about to destroy Earth and clues written on pyramids. It doesn't really make much sense to start off with anyway. So the world will end in a fiery collision in a matter of weeks if one conspiracy theorist is to be believed. Well, obviously one conspiracy theorist shouldn't be believed, because he says September the 20th to the 23rd, it's all going to go pear-shaped. It is.
Election. Is this an election kind of prediction?
Oh, hell, that's a point, actually. I didn't think of that. Wow. Yeah, that's really going to disrupt the election. We'll never find out who won.
I know.
Hell. So, yeah, so he's got this planet called Nibiru, apparently, and obviously we can't see this planet for some reason
at the moment.
It might be, who knows?
Okay.
But this guy reckons that there's things in the Bible, and the way the Great Pyramid of Giza points, he reckons that he puts these two things together.
He reckons.
And he reckons. And he does. This did make me laugh a little bit. He said, it's very strange that both the great sign of Revelation 12 and the Great Pyramid of Giza point us to one precise moment in time, September 20th to 23rd, 2017.
This is crazy, because I've never heard of anyone predicting the end of the world from the Bible or any other religious scripture. So this is mind-blowing, really.
But why was this on the Herald website? It's obviously crap, you know. It just is. It's some crazy person with a crazy theory, and it's not going to happen. And so why publicize it? Why give this person the oxygen of publicity?
Mm.
Why not perhaps have a real science story in its place? You know, let's tell us about these nanomachines we were talking about before, because it's a hell of a sight more interesting, and it's a hell of a sight more truthful than this rubbish.
But will
Ruben's
it get
Ruben's
this,
in there.
will it get as many clicks, though?
Oh, you cynic.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Don't tell me it's all about clicks and not about truth.
Well, it is, though. It's a company.
Guys, we're on Dear Science. We're not talking about the state of the media. Alan Blackman calls the New Zealand Herald crap. Thanks so much for your time, Alan.
Can I just say two things before I depart?
You may.
Non-scientific, but a big shout-out to the Titirangi Volunteer Fire Brigade, who saved our cat from up a tree this morning when it was absolutely pelting down with rain. And this cat was up a 20-metre tree in the middle of the bush, and these guys and girls were busy.
There's a news story.
That's brilliant. Alan Blackman's cat got saved.
And secondly, just to remind everybody or let everybody know that sadly Walter Becker from Steely Dan died a couple of days ago, greatest band of the 70s, if not all time. Go and listen to Asia, because it's a perfect album. There's not a dud note on it.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you so much, Alan.
Thanks.
Chat next week.
That was Dear Science.